Welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are on a listen-only mode until the question and answer session of today's conference. At that time, to ask a question, press star one on your phone and record your name at the prompt. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Bill Finnerbrock. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you, operator, and I want to welcome all of our participants today. My name is Bill Finnerbrock, and I'm the Executive Director of the National Association of Rural Health Clinics, and I'll be the moderator and also doing some participation in today's call. Our principal speaker will be Nathan Baugh, who's the Director of Government Affairs for the National Association of Rural Health Clinics. Our topic is the new emergency preparedness requirements that are effective for rural health clinics and other providers beginning November 15th of 2017. This series is sponsored by the Health Resources and Services Administration's Federal Office of Rural Health Policy and is done in conjunction with the National Association of Rural Health Clinics. We're supported by a cooperative agreement, and as you can see on your screen, through the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy, and that allows us to bring you these calls free of charge. The purpose of the series is to provide RHC staff with valuable technical assistance and RHC-specific information. Today's call is the 78th in the series, which began in late 2004. Over the years, there have been over 21,000 combined participants on this national teleconference and webinar series, now being done as a webinar. As you know, there is no charge to participate, and we encourage you to refer others who might benefit from this information to sign up to receive announcements regarding dates, topics, and speaker presentations. They can go to www.hrsa.gov/rural-health/policy/CONFCALL/index.html. During the Q&A period today, we ask that you identify yourself by name, city, and state when you ask your question, or you can type your question in a chat box that will appear on your screen once we go to the Q&A session. With that, I'd like to introduce our speaker today, our primary speaker, Nathan Baugh. We're going to talk about the emergency preparedness requirements.
Thank you, Bill. And we will dive right into it. There is both my contact information as well as Bill's contact information. That is the same phone number. We work in the same office. So if one of us is not in, the other one should cover for it. All right, so what are we going to cover today? Obviously, we're going to go over the emergency preparedness rule and the specific regulations, which hopefully everyone knows by now are found in 42 CFR 491.12. That's the Rural Health Clinic Emergency Preparedness Rule Citation. In addition to that, there's five sections to 491.12, A, B, C, D, and E. And we're going to go over each section, and then after each section, we're going to talk about the interpretive guidance for that section. So the full interpretive guidance is found in State Operations Manual Appendix Z, and this is guidance to surveyors. So it's the instructions to the surveyors who will be making sure that you are complying with these rules. And so we've just picked some quotes that help color in some of the rules in the various sections. And then at the end, we're going to go over an emergency we've developed, and that template will be available for everyone to use as kind of a guideline when you're creating your own emergency plan. And then, of course, we're going to have some time for question and answers at the end. And obviously, I know that one of the most commonly asked questions is, where is the slides and the audio and the transcript? It will all be posted at the link that you can see on your screen after, as well as if you're logged in on the webinar, there's a file share that you see you should see at the bottom right. You can click that and also download just this. I think the slides are there.
Hi, Nathan. This is Joaquin. Yes. I just want to let you know that you were just a bit choppy, so not sure if there's slightly bad connection on your end, but just wanted to give you a heads up about that.
Okay, Joaquin, can you let us know if it gets worse?
Okay, I sure will. Sounds good now, though.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So this screenshot here, obviously I don't expect anybody to read anything off of this slide. However, I just wanted to demonstrate what we have to comply with today. If a surveyor showed up, you have to comply with those three little things on the left. And it used to be located at the Code of Federal Regulations 491-6C. Now, obviously, it's a much more comprehensive set of rules that we have to deal with, and they're much longer, and that's on the right. So we are amping up what we have to do in terms of emergency preparedness. As Bill mentioned when he did his intro, the implementation date for this rule is November 15th, 2017. If you see the date November 15th, 2016, that's because that's when these rules were finalized, but CMS made it clear that they weren't enforcing it until a year after the rules were finalized. So that's why the enforcement date, if you will, begins on November 15th, 2017. And Bill, do you want to talk about what would happen if you potentially aren't in compliance on November 16th?
Well, I think first, you know, there's been a lot of concern. As Nathan mentioned, the rule is effective on November 15th. We are not anticipating that you're going to see surveyors showing up en masse at rural health clinics on November 16th to begin surveying to see if you're adhering with these new conditions. So I don't want folks, on the one hand, to, you know, think that this is something that is going to happen. What we anticipate is that these will be done as you go through a normal course. If you're an existing RHC, and you come up for recertification, surveyors come out as part of a normal process. This would be part of the requirements you're expected to meet. New rural health clinics, if you're getting certified after November 15th, you're going to have to show in your policy and procedures manual, in all the various documentation and papers, that you've met all the requirements. I think here, hopefully all of you have at least done some of the activities required here, but I think, you know, you're going to need to be able to show the surveyors that if you have written documents that you're required, you're going to want to have those in your policy and procedures manual. In terms of some of the activities, you know, in terms of doing a tabletop exercise we're going to talk about or some of the other planning, that you have a date scheduled for that you can show a surveyor should you be surveyed in the near future, that you have it scheduled and when it is planned for, and that you have all of the documents necessary. You may be cited for a deficiency, but it would be one where you would be given an opportunity to submit a plan of correction, which again would be at what date will you have all your documents in place, will you have your training exercises done, et cetera. So we don't want people kind of getting scared here, but we do want you to become compliant as quickly as possible.
Right. The message is the sky is not falling if you are out of compliance on some part of this when the survey happens, but it's also at the same time you urgently do want to fix that deficiency. So here I have listed what I've called the old regime, which again was those three data points that I had listed on the previous slide, which we had to if you got surveyed today, all you would have to do is demonstrate that you're training staff in handling emergencies, placing exit signs in the proper location, and take other appropriate measures. So it's very, you know, only three points here and not really that comprehensive. As I've mentioned before, the new regime, what I call the new regime of emergency preparedness rules, is again found at 491.12. And that's 42 CFR 491.12. I know this is not going to focus on critical access hospitals and how their requirements are a little different, but I know that there's a lot of overlap. And if you are a part of a CAW or, you know, you're associated with a CAW, that their rules, emergency preparedness rules, are located at 485.625. Okay, so like I said, we're going to go through each of the sections here, the five sections, A, B, C, D, and E, and then the interpretive guidance for each section. So the first subsection here is 49112A, which is what they've called the emergency preparedness plan. It's pretty straightforward. You have to create a plan, and you have to update it every year. And so in our template, you'll note that we have a little log where you can document that you edited X, Y, or Z thing within the plan on this date. So then when a surveyor shows up, you can show them, hey, we updated our plan within the last year. There's a lot of leeway, and I'm going to probably say this several times throughout this presentation, but CMS is not dictating a particular plan. If you use our template, it is not the only way to go about satisfying these requirements. So there's a lot of leeway, and they're very clear about that throughout the interpretive guidelines. What you do have to do is you have to have a strategy to address all the various emergency events the clinic is at risk for. The term in the rule is utilizing an all-hazards approach. So, you know, if you're in the state of Washington and you're located near Mount Helena. And so you might want to have something for volcanic, you know, emergency. But if you're in Kansas, I doubt that you're going to need something on volcanoes. So, but you do want to address all the various emergency events that you could potentially face. And we have examples of those in our template, and at the end we'll go over some. The other thing that you're going to have to do is you want to analyze your capability during and after each of the potential hazards that your clinic would face. And then finally, as a part of the plan portion, this whole thing is what you would consider emergency plan, but these are some general things that you're going to have in this particular section. And one of those is a process to cooperate with the broader community on emergency preparedness. So, you know, you're going to reach out to X, Y, or Z office within your community every year to engage with them on what you need to be doing to be ready for emergency preparedness.
So that would include local fire, police. You may have a county emergency preparedness department in your county. Who are the other individuals or organizations within your community who you would want to partner with as part of an emergency preparedness? There may be other healthcare providers. There may be a nursing home in your community, other medical practices. These requirements are unique to providers under Medicare who are under a survey or certification process. So in your community, you may have a private physician's office that sees Medicare patients. They do not have to do an emergency preparedness. So if you reach out to them and say, hey, we want to partner with you on the new emergency preparedness requirements, they may not know what you're talking about. They still might be somebody you want to partner with. So who are logical individuals within your community who would have a common interest or shared interest in doing emergency planning?
All right, so on your screen is some of the interpretive guidance for this section in State Operations Manual Appendix C. And I didn't write any of these things that are on your screen. These are direct quotes from the guidance. And I just want to go over a couple. Obviously, that first one there, like I said, there is no one format. You can use whatever format works best for you for in terms of the emergency preparedness plan. One thing that I'll point out is the second bullet point. If you're going to evaluate a potential interruption, so let's say the hazard is power's down or water's down, the facility, meaning the rural health clinic, needs to take into account the duration of such interruptions. So that's the instructions to the surveyor. So when you show a surveyor, like, this is what we're going to do when the power's out, that surveyor is supposed to look at the duration that you've considered duration of the power being out. right? So that when you write your plan, you want to think about, okay, what is the surveyor looking for? And those answers are often going to be found in state operation in the Appendix Z, right? There's nothing in the actual rule in 49, that should say 491, I apologize, it's not 492. 49112, there's nothing in 49112 that indicates that you have to consider duration of an interruption. That's only in the appendix, but that's the surveyor is instructed to look for that. So that's just an example. They don't define community in order to give you flexibility to kind of define what you would consider community for the purposes of a community-based risk assessment. I will point out that when you do your all-hazards risk assessment, you want to have two. And one is for your broader community, something that everyone in your town or your community might face. And the other would be specifically for your facility. So if your facility is located near a river or on some sort of hill, or there's trees that go a tree line that's very close to your facility, those might be facility-specific hazards. And so the guidance says to the surveyors that you have to have two risk, all-hazard risk assessments. One is community-based, and one is just for your building and is facility-based. And the final thing here, and this kind of runs with some together with some of the other requirements and some of the other subsections, but it's the last bullet point on your screen. While the responsibility for ensuring a coordinated disaster response does reside with the emergency planning authorities, you must document all your efforts to contact these officials, right? So if they're not particularly well organized in your area, document that you've reached out to X, Y, or Z authority and try to initiate them on a conversation about emergency planning.
This is one of those areas where, with the process starting here soon, you should be able to do, where you want to at least show in your records that you've done this outreach. That's something that you could do now prior to November 15th to at least try to engage those local officials in a conversation about it. We have heard that a lot of state officials in particular are becoming inundated with requests from local providers who want to engage in these activities. So we're hearing reports that they are behind, depending upon the size of your county. Some county officials are getting behind because of inquiries and requests at numbers and at levels they've not heard before, but at least have documented that you've reached out and tried to get in touch with them.
I'm just going to make a quick note on the Appendix Z. That appendix applies to every single facility type that has to comply with emergency preparedness, and there is a lot of crossover. However, it can be confusing because there's stuff in there for hospitals and other facility types that is not applicable to rural health clinics. While the official document is still Appendix Z and you can figure it out, there are resources out there that kind of pull the non-rural health clinic stuff out, and so it can be a little easier to follow. I don't have a link anywhere in this presentation to a RHC-specific interpretive guidance document, but I know that that is available, and it's something that we could potentially put on the listserv. So I just wanted to make that note. So moving on to the second subsection here, 12B, which is the policy and procedures. So this is not a separate, it can be theoretically a separate document, but this is not, you can put this within the emergency plan that you are required to create in subsection A, right? It's pretty straightforward. You have to, again, review and update your policies and procedures annually. Some policies that you are required to have is you must have a policy on evacuation signs, and you have to have staff responsibility during an evacuation. You have to have a policy on sheltering in place. You have to have a system of medical documentation that preserves patient info, and I have some interpretive guidance language on that in the next slide. And then finally, you have to have a plan or a strategy to use volunteers during an emergency. And again, I have some interpretive guidance on that. So I'm going to go ahead and just skip right to that. So the first thing I have here is that facilities must, and again, this is a quote from the State Operations Manual, facilities must consider in their development of policies and procedures the needs of their patient population and what designated transportation services would be most appropriate. So that's just a straightforward, it's pretty straightforward, but you want to have some sort of policy on how you might transport patients that are in need to a different facility. One of the things that you're going to make sure that you need to have is two ways to contact whoever is going to be responsible for that transportation. And this kind of bleeds over into one of the requirements in the next subsection, but it's a primary and a secondary means of communication, meaning that you're not reliant purely on the internet or you're not purely reliant on your cell phone, but you have two ways to contact the people you need to contact, including whoever might be responsible for transporting any patient that needs it or anyone that needs it to a different facility. The last bullet point, if you look on this page, says that in addition to any existing requirements for patient records found in existing laws, under this standard, facilities are required to ensure that patient records are secure and readily available to support continuity of care during an emergency. So this requirement, a lot of people have viewed it as a de facto EHR requirement. I'm not sure how you could satisfy that necessarily via paper. I've heard some people say, well, we'll have a very secure file cabinet that won't get burned down and is, I guess, resistant to water damage maybe, and, you know, that will suffice. But I think the easiest and the way that most people are going to comply with this requirement is backing things up to some sort of cloud system.
Yeah, I think we do have to recognize that in the RHC community, many of you may not have an EHR and then that kind of a cloud backup capability. So I do think that ensuring that the file cabinets you have are secure, that the file cabinets are fireproof, and the file cabinets can sustain a certain level of whatever damage. I had a conversation yesterday with Kate Hill from the compliance team about this question, and you know, I think there's a question of reasonableness. What reasonable steps are you taking to ensure that records are available? You know, if your building, you know, blows away because of a hurricane, is the expectation that the file cabinet is still going to be sitting there and secure? I mean, obviously there are circumstances that you're simply not going to be able to ensure that it is preserved in lieu of everything else being destroyed. But have you taken reasonable, responsible steps to ensure that in the light of a fire, in light of floods, that there is an opportunity to be able to preserve those records? So I think EHR maybe, or electronic file or an offsite system where you could have a backup set of files is great if that's feasible. But I also think taking reasonable steps to secure them in file cabinets would also be sufficient to meet this requirement.
Right, and I think that's a good example of, at the end of the day, even with all the guidance released, some of this does come down to a judgment call of what the surveyor thinks is appropriate. So it's just, the quote I have is the instructions to the surveyor. So that's the most detail that the surveyor is looking for. All right, so we're going to go to the third subsection here, which is the subsection C, which is the communication plan. Again, communication plan must be updated annually, could potentially be a separate document from the emergency plan, could also be within the emergency plan. You just definitely need to have one. Pretty straightforward, you need to have contact info for all of those entities that I have listed there. And as I mentioned earlier, you have to have the primary and alternate means of communication. On the next slide, I have some interpretive guidance language on what exactly primary and alternate means of communication means. There's a part of your communication plan must be a way to provide info about your, you must include a plan to provide info about your ability to help during an emergency, as well as the condition of your REC. Is it damaged? You know, where your patients are sheltering in place, or where your patients evacuate to. If you did evacuate, you would want to have all of those, the ability to communicate those, that information to the local emergency preparedness authorities. So here's some guidance from the Appendix C. The first point here is that if you're in a rural or remote area, which most rural health clinics are, you need to ensure that your communication plan addresses how you would communicate and comply with this requirement in the absence of internet, all right? And they list satellite phones, radios, and shortwave radios. I think the key here is if you don't have internet and you don't have if the cell tower that you use is down, how are you going to communicate? Also, if you don't have power, how are you going to communicate? So something that is like a satellite phone or a radio that can be charged and will still function without power, without internet, that would be key to having that secondary means of communication, right? And the second bullet point is kind of along the same lines. It just gives you some various ideas of how they might expect you to show that you have met this requirement. All right, so now we're on to the fourth subsection of the rules, and this is training and testing. And this is perhaps what we've heard is the hardest to implement and to comply with. This is the kind of section that takes the most time. You must train your staff, all staff and contractors, consistent with their expected roles, and you have to have one documented training for all those staff members every year. When the surveyor comes, I think I don't have it in the slides, but the surveyor will ask staff what their role is during an emergency, a hypothetical emergency, and they're going to evaluate whether or not the staff is aware of their responsibility, right? You have to do two drills or exercises. Now, this gets a little complicated, so bear with me. One of your exercises must be a full-scale community-based exercise. You have to do that once a year. Then you can do another community-based exercise, or you can do a tabletop exercise for your second exercise. So it's either two full-scale community-based exercises or one full-scale community-based exercise and a tabletop exercise. On all of these, anytime you do an exercise or a tabletop exercise or a community-based drill, document, document, document. And because if you don't document it, the surveyor's not going to know that you did it, right? Include a section within your emergency plan where you will document this. You know, say, we've documented all our exercises on tab whatever, and every time you do an exercise, document it. Include an evaluation of how your clinic did, what things you can learn from the exercise, et cetera, all in that section. I will note that if you have an emergency and you execute some portion of your emergency preparedness plan, if you actually put this into place, that does count for one of your community-based exercises. So there's a little silver lining. Hopefully it's not too serious, but if you implement your emergency plan, that will count for one of your drills. There's a lot of resources already available, and there will be more and more resources available on drills and exercises, I think, over the years. And so CMS, just be on the lookout for those from CMS. And I have some links at the end of this slide where those will be posted. This is important. CMS clarified in one of the FAQs, round five, FAQ round five, that these two exercises must be performed before November 15th. So even though this is being starting to be enforced this November 15th, they will have, if you get a surveyor at your doorstep on November 16th, they will have expected you to have done these two exercises within the previous year, right? So you don't get a year starting November 15th to perform these exercises, right? So you need to do those now, Bill.
Yeah, and this is one of those areas where, you know, I think there's a lot of concern. Obviously, here we are November 2nd, and, you know, if you haven't done it, you've got technically 13 days to get this done. And, you know, you're simply not going to be able to do that. I think this is an area where you want to get on this. You don't want to delay. I would put together a calendar as soon as possible, identifying the dates at which this will occur, again, who you have reached out to. So in the event that you do have a surveyor show up within the, you know, next month or so, that you are in the process of getting this done and you will have a date at which this will occur as part of your plan of correction. I think also for new RHCs, obviously it is not possible for them to have done this already. So for those who are coming newly into the program, it is prospective rather than retrospective. But for those of you who are existing RHCs, this is something I would not continue to put off, and at least get something on your calendar so that in the event you are surveyed, you can document and show that you are in the process of getting this done.
Thank you, Bill. So here's some quotes from the Appendix Z. The first one here is facilities are expected to contact their local and state agencies and healthcare coalitions. This is something that we've kind of mentioned already. Make sure you document when you reach out to your local and state agencies in the scenario that your community is still a little bit behind or they're not very helpful. At least show that you've documented and you've tried to reach out to the appropriate authorities. Now, if you are in the scenario where there's not a good community-based exercise happening on your timeline, like maybe you do reach out and they're like, yeah, we have a community-based exercise scheduled for March, right? But you know that you have a survey before then, well, you might want to consider doing this. If you look at the second bullet point, you can do what they're calling an individual facility-based exercise. So you would basically document that, hey, I reached out and the community-based exercise isn't occurring until too late, or we can't do the community-based exercise because their community isn't on top of it, or whatever the reason is. And then you're allowed to do what they're calling an individual-based exercise. And again, you have to document that, but you can basically use your imagination to. And there's guidance online, and there's a link at the end that will kind of give you some ideas of what these drills are supposed to look like. But you come up with a scenario, and you do it, right? And you can be individual facility-based. So the lack of a community-based exercise occurring in your area is not an excuse for not doing this section. And then finally, at the bottom here is that you, again, document everything. One of the things that the surveyor is looking for is that you have some sort of after-action report on ways that you can improve for next time. And it's just very important that you document anytime you do a test.
Yeah, and there are tests that can be even smaller in scale. For example, you could do an active shooter scenario in your clinic, does not necessarily involve significant participation. You may, from local police, or certainly want to make them aware, and this is one of those areas you want to communicate to a lot of people, that if you're doing an active shooter drill, that you know, you make people aware that there's a drill so you don't create unnecessary panic. But there are smaller scale activities that you can engage in that don't necessarily involve your emergency preparedness folks at a county level or in a community level, but maybe smaller in scale to police, potentially fire and rescue in the event that there are injuries, things of that nature. But don't always think about these as large-scale initiatives. Some of them you can scale down, that it would literally be just involving your clinic and some local law enforcement officials.
Great. Thanks, Bill. So the last subsection here, subsection E, is about integrated healthcare systems. And I know a lot of rural health clinics are looking at this section as a way or doing an integrated healthcare system plan. I think the proper name is the Coordinated Emergency Preparedness Program. If you participate in that, you will satisfy the rural health clinic rules. However, you need to be very careful that you are meeting all the requirements and that your broader systems emergency preparedness program is meeting all the requirements. And they're very keen, CMS is very keen on emphasizing that every single facility that is a part of that broader coordinated program must demonstrate that they are compliant. If one facility is not in compliance, technically the entire system's coordinated emergency program is out of compliance. So if you don't trust someone else in your broader system, then you know you might not want to do this. I will say that this is completely optional. Just because you belong to a healthcare system does not mean you have to take this approach, but you can. Completely optional. And I'm going to go into some of the guidance on that. They are very keen on ensuring that their participants from every single facility within the system. They want the surveyor is going to ask that the coordinated preparedness plan demonstrate that there was one person from each facility at, let's say, the meeting where they do the planning, and you're going to have to document that every single facility was actively participating in setting up this plan. Again, the second bullet point here is kind of a reiteration of there is no one format, no one-size-all-fits-model that can be prescribed. However, again, each facility participating must be in full compliance or else the entire the unified emergency preparedness program is out of compliance. Bill? Okay. All right, so that is our summary of the rules and some of the guidance. The next thing that we're going to go into is a template, because I know that going over the rules and some of the guidance, sometimes it's easier to just get into the actual work. Okay, what do I need to do? And we have to give a huge shout out, if you will, to the Louisiana Department of Health, who really did a lot of the work in developing a template. I know that there's other great templates out there that other folks have developed. So this is by no means the one and only template, but it's one of the first ones that we've seen. They really did a great job. And theirs is geared, obviously, specifically towards Louisiana. And you can read or you can see their plan at the link that I have in the webinar. We've gone through and made some minor edits, just trying to remove the Louisiana-specific references and create a little bit more of a generic version, which you can download on our website. You can also download it at that link. If you click it or you put it into your browser, it won't take you to a web page. It's just going to start downloading through your browser a Word document. Okay? Again, this is not a guarantee that, oh, if you use our template, you're going to be totally fine and a surveyor won't mark you up on something. It's just simply an example, help you get started, and you can pick and pull pieces of this that you like, and if you see a different template that you like, you can pull pieces out from that as well. No one format required. So, with that, I'm going to just go into a few characteristics of the template that Louisiana developed and that we're kind of using here. And all this, obviously, this is a table of contents page here. And all I'm trying to do here is show that when you're writing when you're going through section by section, one way to organize it is think, okay, I just went through A, B, C, D, and E of the rules, right? Well, when you're writing your plan, just write your plan, okay, read the rule. How are we addressing that particular aspect in our plan, right? So I kind of have crosswalked the regulation with the subsection, right, and the section in your emergency plan. If you look at the template that we've developed online, I go even into the more detailed sections within the code and kind of giving you the reference. So when you're writing it, you can see what rule you need to satisfy in that particular section when you're writing your own emergency plan.
And it may seem obvious here, but I think, the first thing you all have to do, and it's highlighted there, but is your emergency plan, and it's the first thing, the risk assessment. What are the risks that are likely or potentially going to occur in your community? As Nathan said, if you're in the Pacific Northwest, it might be a volcano. If you're in the Midwest, it might be a tornado. If you're in the Gulf region, it might be a hurricane. If you're in the far west, it might be fires. And then there are other local events that can occur. But you have to do that and sit down and come up with a reasonable list of what are the potential risks that might occur in our community, and then do everything from there. So you've got to do that risk assessment first.
All right. So, again, this is just the way we designed, or really Louisiana designed their template, is they kind of have a narrative section, which is what you see here, and then they have tabs and situational risk annexes that they put at the end, right? And so the first section is what you would write for, that's kind of in general stuff that is applicable across every single type of emergency. You have to have a shelter in place plan regardless of the, you know, your various risk assessment. Let's say you're not in a place that has tornadoes, so you might not think that you would need a shelter in place plan. Well, that is a part of the policy and procedure requirement, so everyone's going to need a shelter in place plan regardless, right? So those are the kind of things that we put in the narrative section. And then you have tabs that you can swap in and out as necessary. So a good example of this is your organizational chart and your contacts, right? You might not want to bake all that information into your more narrative section of your plan. You might want to have that standalone in its own tab so you can swap it in and out as the contacts change. As your organizational structure changes, you can swap in and out that tab and you don't have to re-edit your narrative portion. So that's just a suggestion. That's how Louisiana did it. And then, of course, at the end here, we have situational risk annexes, which are specific to the particular type of hazard, right? And this is what you would include for, obviously, anything that you're going to do specifically for X, Y, or Z hazard or risk. And so I have an example of the fire. Then this was, again, this is very much exactly what Louisiana put together, but this is just Annex A, fire, right? And their procedure is race. So first you got to rescue, R. Then you have to alert the fire department, A. C is contain the fire. And then E is extinguish the fire if the fire is small. And then they have little notes in here, right? Never aim at the top of the flames because it's going to cause the fire to spread. If you can't extinguish the fire, evacuate the building immediately. The most common cause of death in fire is smoke, not the flames, so be aware of that. You want to stay low to the floor to avoid inhaling too much smoke. And so this is just their fire procedure. You can have a different fire procedure, but this is, you know, everything that is specific to a fire would go in this annex. This is, again, one way to structure it. That's how this template is structured. There are other ways to structure it as well. I'm going to point out that I'm just going to skip over that slide real quick. This ASPR-TRACY link which is the bottom link on this page, has resources that I think are particularly good for the specific hazard section. So there, you can search on that website and you can find facilities plans for X, Y, and Z emergency. And I think it's a good resource when you're looking for, okay, well, what am I going to do during a bioterrorism or a radiological event? There's good resources on the Aspertracy link.
Yeah, and I think, you know, many of you, this is a great point because several of these hazards, there are things that you can pretty well predict are going to and how you might respond, fire, some of the natural disasters. But as Nathan points out there, you can go and get some insight and perspective on things that hopefully may never occur, a biohazard, terrorism, mm-hmm. things of that nature. But, you know, you have to think about that type of an activity, unfortunately, in the world today. So those are good resources for that.
Yep. So I skipped over this slide briefly, and all of the quotes that I pulled on the interpretive guidance come from this link. Again, the State Operations Manual, Appendix C. This is the instruction to the surveyors. I think it's very good for everyone to have this document up and on your screen as you are writing your emergency preparedness plan, right? Because that is what the what the surveyors are going to be looking for. So that is the link to that. Again, State Operations Manual, Appendix D. And then there, the other two links that I have on this page, obviously that first bullet point is an email, and that's to CMS. So if you have questions and you want an official answer from CMS, there is an email address where you can submit your questions, scgemergencyprep@cms.hhs.gov. And then finally, that middle link is kind of just it's what comes up if you Google CMS emergency preparedness. It's not anything crazy. It's the main kind of hub for CMS. It has all the useful FAQs. That's where I got the information that you have to be ready on November 15, 2017, right? That came from FAQ 5. I got FAQ 5 from that link, right? So it's some good information there, and they have a lot of other useful information on that page as well. So I believe that concludes our presentation, and we're going to open it up for questions. If we could get the chat box active, and as well as operator, if you want to give the instructions for submitting a question or asking a question over the phone.
Thank you. If you'd like to ask a question through the phone, please press *1 and make sure your phone is unmuted and record your name clearly when prompted. Your name will be required to introduce your question. If you need to withdraw your question, you may press *2. Again, to ask a question, please press *1 and record your name. We'll take a moment for questions to come through. Please stand by.
And there it is. I think the chat box should have appeared if you're on the webinar, and we'll try to get to questions on that as well. But we'll start on the phones first. Operator, do we have anybody ready?
Yes, our first question comes from Mary. Your line is open.
Hi, Mary. Where are you
Hello.
From?
Yes, and I also have Bob here. He's going to ask you a question. Go ahead, Bob.
Where do you get the list of these CFRs where they're spelled out? We're part of a critical access hospital. The clinic's located in the hospital, and they're part of the emergency management plan within the community and such as that. But I was looking at trying to get a list of the specific list of the rules or the standards for this so that we can just create a small manual that addresses those items instead of the 500 or so that's in our environment and care policies, and just so I can address them by number in a separate manual that's for easy reference.
I think our template, if you take a look at our template, it kind of crosswalks the emergency plan kind of section with the rules. Is that what you're asking?
Do you have, it has them listed out like It's 459.3. Is that how they, I mean, do they list that in that way, or is it so we can make a crosswalk from our
Our template does that where it can. So if you go, I'm going to go back to that.
Yeah, go back to the slide so we can copy the.
So.
And you can download those slides and get them electronically and just follow the links. But that is all in there. Those links will take you there. And same way with the guidance, the emergency, the interpretive guidance will show you the particular section of the regulation. What state are you in?
Illinois.
Because some of the states are also developing. I know we've used Louisiana. I've heard other states. You may want to check to see if your state has created a template as well.
To my knowledge, they haven't yet. We have an attached long-term care facility and a couple of clinics that are within the hospital, and we were surveyed on the long-term care part this summer, and they were fine with everything that we do with the hospital emergency preparedness and the nursing home and things being part of the hospital response plan because they are, and the clinics are as well.
The problem with the regulations, and I think either the template or the interpretive guidelines are better documents, is the regulations are written for everybody.
Right.
And then they will have a footnote that says, well, this section does not apply to
interpretive guidance.
But it's easier if you follow the template or things of that nature, I think.
Okay. That's kind of what we're trying to do is just put out of what we already have. I know we already have all the items. And we have, you know, the drills, the full-blown community, and the individuals. But just to put something together that's easy to follow that's out of this that utilizes what we already have.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay, so we have a bunch of questions in the chat that we're going to try to get to and kind of rapid fire here. Billy asks if we have any recommendations on generators. Unfortunately, we don't. Generators is not a rural health clinic requirement. That is something that I know hospitals and other facility types are required to have, but I do not believe that that rural health clinics are required to have a generator, at least from an emergency preparedness plan standpoint. Donna asks if we can confirm that her plan will count for the community drill. Donna, I'm just going to need more details on that. You can email me. My contact information is at the beginning. I can't confirm that because I need more information from you. I don't know if what they've implemented would be counted as a community drill.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Just you're going to have to give me more information, Donna. I'm sorry. Moving on to Kim's question. Do we have to have a policy on how we ensure that the patient records are secure? Yes. So as Bill was saying earlier, you know, he thinks that if you have a very good, sturdy file cabinet that's in a secure location that's going to withstand fire and water damage, that would suffice in terms of keeping patient records secure during an emergency event. I think the other way that most people or many folks are going to satisfy this requirement is to effectively back up to the cloud.
Yeah, on that point, too, on the backup, when folks say backup to the cloud or whatever, it's kind of a neat marketing term, but it's not always clear. What's important is wherever you're doing your backup, that it be in a location that is not likely to be affected by the same emergency that is causing you to trigger your plan. So let's say you're across the street from the hospital, you're an RHC, and you're backing your files up on the server of the hospital, and you go, well, we have our servers here in the clinic, and our backup is across the street at the hospital. Well, if there's going to be an outage in the area, that outage, power outage, is more than likely going to affect the hospital as well as your clinic. So your backup plan isn't very good because you haven't got it in a location where the same emergency that's affecting you is also affecting where you have your backup. So just give a little bit of thought. If you are using electronic backup, where is that site located and whether or not that site is vulnerable to the same emergency?
But, yes, you have to have a policy. You have to develop something to keep your patient records secure. We're going to do a few more in the chat, and then we'll go back to over the phone. Elizabeth asks a question about if she just passed certification and is pending CMS approval for CMS, then we are not yet held to have exercises done by 11/16.
If you've had your inspection, if the surveyors have already been there, you're inspected based on the criteria that exists at the time of your inspection, you would not then be subject to a retroactive reinspection once we're past the 15th. So hopefully you'll get your approval and you've submitted your plan of correction if there were any deficiencies. But once you have been inspected and determined to be in compliance, you're good to go.
Brenda Huggins asked if we can print the info today. Yes, I think the suggested way to do that would be to either go to the link that I have in the very first slide or the download the file that's at the bottom right box, and once you download it, you should be able to print it.
And then also the template will be available on the Office of Rural Health Policy's website. It's available on the National Association of Rural Health Clinics website. If you got the notice about this meeting, you should have also received a link to the template as it is up on the NARHC site. If you're unable out of any of that to still get something of way of a printed document, contact Nathan. You have his contact information on the first slide, and we'll make arrangements to get that information to you. But there are a number of places you can get that information downloaded so you can print it.
Operator, can we take a call over the phone?
Yes. Our next question comes from Nick. Your line is open.
Hi, Nick. Where are you from?
Hi. Calling from Washington.
Great.
Regarding the community disaster participation, is there a degree of participation required, or is that something that a couple of representatives from the RHC can attend and then report back to the rest of the staff?
This is a good question, and it's actually we did a presentation earlier in the year, and it was asked as well then. There's no requirement as to a minimum number of people or maximum number of people from your facility required to participate in X, Y, or Z exercise. A lot of that requirement will be up to the individual exercise, the nature of the exercise. You know, and I think my example that I've created in my head is if we're going to have an emergency drill, a community-based drill where we say the west side of town is completely destroyed by a fire or by a tornado and everything on that side is shut down, obviously you're going to want to move everyone to the other facility on the east side of town, right? Conversely, if your side of town is the side of town that's maybe receiving a higher volume of patients because the emergency event is happening on the other side of town, then you don't have to have anyone leave the facility because everyone's coming to you. So it's all just dependent. What I'm trying to say is it's dependent on the nature of the drill, the nature of the community-based exercise. So what you're saying sounds like it would be compliant. I will note that everyone needs to be trained on what to do. However, not everyone in your rural health clinic, there's no language that requires a certain percentage or certain number of participants from each rural health clinic.
And I would add to that, I think, you know, if you look at Nathan's example, you also have to factor in the possibility of what happens to your staff in his situation. Let's say you're on the side of the town that is not harmed by whatever the emergency is, but a number of your staff have homes on the part of town that is damaged under your exercise. Can you reasonably expect that those individuals are going to be available to assist with the emergency, or are they going to be dealing with, their own families, their own homes? So think about all of the various aspects of a scenario, even to the point of are the people that you are thinking are going to be available actually going to be available, or are they going to be dealing with their own circumstances,
right,
relative to that emergency?
And I think the concern that was expressed before and that I know people have is that, well, am I going to have to shut down my clinic for a day? I can't afford to shut down my clinic so we all can go participate in a community-based exercise. Well, if the design of the exercise would require you to shut down your clinic, then maybe you do have to do that. But if the exercise says, no, we don't want you to shut down, in fact, we would want you to continue to operate, then you wouldn't have to shed. So there's not really, it's just dependent on the exercise. All right, so we're going to jump back to some questions in the chat box. There's not even a name here, but somebody asks, regarding the community drill, does this include the did that satisfy your question? I'm sorry. Are you still on the line?
Yeah. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Somebody asks, community drill, does this include emergency management team, police, fire, or does it have to include receiving sites as well? Again, this is variable. You might be doing something where you're receiving extra patients or you're transferring patients. It just depends on the community drill. So I can't really answer this for you. Again, like if it's an active shooter, and it might be just a facility-based drill, that would not really require, you know, if the shooter is at your location, you're not going to get necessarily other receiving sites involved in a situation like that. So it depends on the community drill. Marcy Villanueva asks, I'm not clear on the transportation of patients. We're a small office. Would we be required to use our own vehicles to transport patients? You might have a policy. I understand that you're a small office, but if there was an emergency event at your small office, how would you transfer patients to the closest hospital? Let's say there was a fire. That could be your policy. If there's a fire and patients are severely burned, you know, the best way to get them to the place that they need, we can't take care of them in the clinic because there's a fire there. We would use our cars to take them to the hospital. That would be something that you could put in your plan. Again, CMS is not prescriptive on this. They give you that option to kind of use logic to figure out how you would help in X, Y, or Z scenario.
Yeah, I mean, the question has to be asked, how did the patients get to the clinic in the first place? Maybe they drove their own vehicles, in which case they could, depending, again, as Nathan suggested, the type of emergency, they can drive their own vehicles. They don't necessarily have to evacuate. I think if the evacuation plans are a little bit more complicated and difficult if you're talking about a nursing home, if you're talking about a hospital where you have patients who are hooked up to equipment, who are immobile. In a clinic situation, the evacuation plan may be we clear the building and individuals disperse if it's an event inside the building. If it's a hurricane, you know, we get people out, they go home. It's not asking you to take on a level of responsibility that is beyond your capacity, but simply think about it in the context of the circumstance that occur. If we had to evacuate, what would we do? How would people get out of the building? How would they get out of this area? And it may involve use of your vehicles, but it may also just involve use of their own vehicles because that's how they got to the clinic in the first place.
Okay, so I'm trying to do as many of these. I'll do a few more on the chat, and then we'll go back to the phones. Donna asked, if we have a fire drill involving the fire department, can this count as a drill? Again, you're going to have to give me extra details. It could definitely count, but it might not count if you're just, you know, doing like, oh, let's ring the bell, everybody go stand outside for 5 minutes. That might not count. It just depends on what kind of a fire drill you're having. Jeanette asks, are there similar requirements at the community government level to give us better chances of participation at the local level? This is a good question. I'm not entirely sure if local governments are under some sort of federal law to be ready to provide assistance to you. I think most cases the answer is yes, that your community government, whether they're required to or not, will be ready to assist you in the emergency preparedness requirements. But I'm not aware of a federal mandate that the county, let's say, or your local city, it might vary. I think some states organize this by county. Some states organize it by region. In Louisiana, they organize it, I think, by, like, parish. So it's variable.
Federal grant programs that state and local governments may obtain for emergency management planning purposes. Many counties do have an emergency planning program. I think what you need to do is reach out to the local officials. To the extent that they're not under any kind of an obligation, simply try to explain to them what your situation is and come up with a plan. Much as you're concerned, I suspect, with the consumption of resources and time, your local police and fire are going to be as well. You may have a local volunteer fire department in your community as opposed to a paid fire department. Your police officers and sheriffs may be covering a large geographic area. I think, as Nathan has pointed out on a number of occasions, there's flexibility here in trying to work out what is reasonable in the context of your community and what you can do. But the point here is think about the emergencies that might occur. Do your planning. Make sure your folks understand the plan of what to do to the extent possible. Create a scenario where you can test the plan, see where the weaknesses are, see where the strengths are. You obviously cannot anticipate every possible scenario. You're not going to, you may plan for one and you get something completely different. What they're asking is give some thought, do some training, do some effort to try and get yourself prepared and make sure your staff understand that you do have plans and what those plans are. I think one of the most critical ones is this communication tool. What do you do? Because we are so internet dependent, because we are so electronic dependent, what do you do if the phone goes down? What do you do if the internet goes down? Do you have a communication backup at a minimum? How do you reach anybody? There are some simple things that you can do. I wouldn't overanalyze. I wouldn't overstress on it. But think of what are some reasonable things, some things that are likely or potentially going to happen in your community. How would you plan for it? How would you prepare for it? And make sure that your staff is prepared.
So I know we've run over our time. It's past 3 o'clock. We're going to go about maybe 15 more minutes, try to answer as many questions as we possibly can on the phone and through the chat, but we might not get to everyone. Operator, do we have a call on the line?
I show no questions in the queue at this time.
No questions online. Okay, so I'm going to try to get through as many of these questions in the chat box. Mary asks, we have 6 clinics that are under our hospital. Does each clinic need an EPP per clinic besides the hospital? I'm not exactly sure what EPP means.
Emergency and procedures.
Okay, emergency policy and procedures or emergency preparedness person. I'm not sure what your acronym of EPP means. You're going to need to review 49112E if you're going to do the integrated plan, right? There, you're going to need a person from each facility to participate in the development of the integrated plan. You're going to need policies, potentially policies and procedures that address your facility situation specifically, while other policies and procedures are a part of the larger integrated plan. All right, so you could maybe have a shared community-based hazards analysis and then individual facility-based hazards analysis for each of the clinics under your hospital. Ken Moyer asks, does the statewide earthquake shakeout drill count as a community-based drill? Ken, again, send me more details potentially. I'm not sure what the shakeout drill is, and maybe you could send me more details and I could give you a better answer. Linda asks, how will fire drills be looked at by the surveyors as part of the prescribed 2 exercises and drills? Will they be accepted or frowned on? I mean, I think a fire is perhaps one of the most common emergencies or hazards that rural health clinics will face. So I don't think that fire drills will be frowned upon. However, there's a difference between implementing a full, community-based exercise and just ringing the alarm, standing out, like what we all did in school. There's a difference there, right? So I think the surveyor is going to look for more than, in a fire, we all just evacuate and we all go stand on the other side of the road. They're going to be looking for more than that.
Yeah, say, for example, you do have a fire. So the first step is you evacuate the building. But what if the fire does damage to your refrigeration and you have drugs or biologics that you're storing there and you have patients who are going to need those drugs or biologics. What are you going to do? What if it destroys your exam rooms and you're not going to be able to see patients? What if there are there oxygen tanks in the building? Are there materials in the building that if they catch fire are going to emit a noxious smoke that could cause damage? So, you know, a fire drill, as Nathan said, that we had when we were all in school, where you simply all get in line and go out onto the football field or the soccer field and get in line, probably isn't sufficient because you haven't thought through all of the consequences of a fire that could be a part of it, evacuating the building, but what are all the other events that can occur or consequences that can occur as a result of a fire in your building?
Virginia asked, November 15th is a hard date for completion, but CMS may not get to it immediately. Is this new? Yeah, as Bill said, surveyors are not going to be able to show up at all, you know, 4,100 rural health clinics on November 16th and demand your emergency preparedness plan. November 15th is the day for every survey going forward. The surveyor is going to be looking for this, but you shouldn't delay, but you need to be compliant for your next survey. So it's not the sky is falling if on November 16th, you know, you're gearing up for a community-based drill in December. You know, the sky is not falling, but you've done your plan. You know, technically you haven't done your two drills, but you have one coming up. It's going to be a good community-based drill. And, you know, so again, it's the hard date from which surveyors are going to be asking for proof that you've implemented 49112.
And that doesn't mean there isn't some facility where they aren't going to show up in order to, for no other reason, to send a message to others and publicize that, hey, we turned up at, you know, XYZ facility and they were in noncompliance and put that word out. So, you know, it sends a message to the community that they're serious about getting this enforced. But, you know, as I said earlier, these requirements apply to every type of facility that comes under a survey and certification process. So it's all hospitals, all critical access hospitals, all skilled nursing facilities, home health agencies, rural health clinics, federally qualified health centers, ambulatory surgical centers, dialysis treatment facilities, on and on and on. So we know based on that there simply is insufficient manpower to go out and begin doing these things on a wide scale. So that is why we're saying, you know, they're realistically not going to be showing up on the 16th, but that also shouldn't be seen as, oh, okay, I really don't have to do this. They're probably not going to be here for a couple years. I'll worry about it later. I think this is something you need to get on to immediately, but it's not a, you know, stop seeing patients and make sure we get this done. Otherwise, we're going to be shut down.
All right, so I'm going to skip some of the questions that are a little repetitive, such as Kim's. I think we've covered the fire drill stuff. You know, someone asked if they met with emergency management and discussed what they would do in different scenarios and steps, would that count as a community drill and can then do tabletop? I'm not entirely clear on what you mean. It sounds like a discussion with the emergency management authority sounds more of like a tabletop, because it's just a discussion. A community-based drill, again, and if you go to the interpretive guidance, State Operations Manual Appendix Z, it has a lot more color on what would count as a community-based drill and what would count as a tabletop drill.
Yeah, so, and my sense is that's more of a tabletop thing, but my question would be, was there any documentation, you know, of what was talked about, what was discussed, what plans were made or not made? And you know, it's the same thing in the medical record, as many of you know. If it's not in the medical record, it didn't happen. If you didn't document what went on in that community meeting with those local officials, if you don't have a record of it, it didn't happen.
This Kim has a good question that I know I've gotten before. We're an REC within the walls of a CAW. Are we required to have a separate plan/booklet of policies for ourselves, or can we be named within the cost plan? The answer is, well, you can be a part of the integrated healthcare plan, which you need to do even though you're within the walls of the call. I think it's technically considered a separate facility. So you might want to consider you know, what the CAW space can do that your RET space can't. You can be named in the CAWS plan, but you got to be careful here. I would just, my recommendation to you, Kim, would be to read 49112E, which is goes over the integrated health stuff, and make sure that someone from your facility is participating with the CAW as they create their plan. Make sure that you've done some special considerations to what's in the rural health clinic wing of the building, and you know how that might differ from the CAW, the rest of the building at large. But I don't think I would advise you not to just say, "Oh well, our plan is the same as the CAW, and we're just named in it, and that's really all you have." I think that you would want to show that your kind of separate facility and staff is participating.
Yeah, and I think here, not just for you, but for the critical access hospital leadership, one of the things that surveyors are instructed to do is contact and communicate with various staff within a facility, if it's an REC, with REC staff, within the CAW, with the CAW staff, to say, you know, are you aware of the plan? Where would you find the plan? Have you participated in any of the exercises? And so if they come down to the Rural Health Clinic and you're part of the Critical Access Hospital's plan, and they say, okay, I want to meet with the manager of the clinic. Well, where's your emergency plan? Oh, it's somewhere up in administration. Well, have you ever read it? Are you familiar with it? What are you going to do? To say, well, we just rely on the folks from the hospital to tell us, you know, the hospital is going to have a problem as well as you're going to have a problem. So while being inside the hospital, it's probably easier to be part of an integrated hospital plan. There has to be documentation and evidence that you are part of that plan, you're familiar with that plan, and you have been part of the development of the plan or potential carrying out of that plan as part of any exercise you might have had there for the hospital.
The key for you is 49112E. 491. Everyone that's going to do this with their hospital, with their CAW, go over 49112E and read the interpretive guidance on that section and Appendix Z. Read the rules on that section and make sure that your facility is still participating. Don't just put all the responsibility on the hospital. All right. Sheila asked, I think we've addressed this, our full-scale based exercise is scheduled for November 17th. If a surveyor shows up and we show this documentation, will we be okay? I would hope that a surveyor doesn't shut down your RHC because you have a full-scale exercise one day late. So I think you'll be okay. Karen, yes, you'll be able to get a copy of these slides. It's in the bottom right. There's a link, and there's also links online. Just Google it. You will find it. Carla, if you cannot get community involvement for a drill, can you document this and then do two in-house drills? Again, Carla, I'm going to flip to the section quickly that covers this, the training and testing. Read that second bullet point here. This is the interpretive guidance on this. If you are not able to, and this is from the interpretive guidance, not able to identify a full-scale community-based exercise, you can instead fulfill this part of the requirement by conducting an individual facility-based exercise. So I think that answers your question. Can you do both this way? Yes, but I would just note that continue to document that you're trying to reach out to the broader community to do the community-based exercise, right? So I don't just go straight to, oh, well, I'm not going to deal with the broader community. I'm going to do my own in-house drill. And you need to show that you've at least tried to reach out and get a community-based drill started before you do the in-house. Tiffany asks, if we only have an EHR that is cloud-based, what other options for backup are there? We are an independent REC in a small community with no hospital.
I mean, your cloud-based backup should be fine. The only point I was making earlier is where is that backup? You know, that the word cloud has little in the way of meaning. Do you know where that – so when you back up in the cloud, you're essentially saving that information on a server that is located someplace else. Where is that someplace else? Is that server in the town that you're located in? Is it in another state? And if you had to get access to that information, what is your process for accessing that? So just simply saying it's in the cloud, I think you need to get a little bit more information. Talk to your internet service provider. Talk to whoever is doing your electronic systems and say, where is this being backed up? So that if we have an emergency, what is the mechanism for me to access that information? And then put that into your plan and document that of, okay, here's what would happen if we lost access to our files here because of our in-house server. This information is backed up in Kaspersky, or this information is backed up someplace, and this is how I would go about getting it.
Okay, Beth, now we're going to ask, get a few more in, and then we'll probably have to end it. Operator, do we have any calls on the line?
I show no questions in the queue at this time.
All right, we're just going to get one or two more questions in, and if there are more questions, obviously the listserv is always a good resource, and our contact information, I'll put that back up. You can feel free to email Bill or myself or call us, and we will do our best to assist you. Bethany asks, can our coordination with local emergency preparedness officials take place via representatives from our call? No. In my interpretation of what you're asking, I would say that you need to have someone from your team. So I think while it can be as a group, you can do it with the CAW. Your representative can go with the CAW's representative. Each separate facility has to have someone at the plate. Mm-hmm. And again, I'll go to that section of the interpretive guidance, and I think it might color in a little bit of that. So right here, if you read on the first bullet point, second sentence, each facility should designate personnel who will collaborate with the healthcare system to develop the plan. I think that person would need to participate in all the meetings and all the coordination. That's how I would interpret it, I would advise you to have your representative from your RHC go with the representative from the CAW. That's how I would interpret it. And Jeanette asked, does actual water or electric outages we encounter at our RHC as an exercise or count as an exercise if we perform an after-action assessment for our emergency plan? Yes, but you must execute your emergency plan. So if the power goes out for a very short period of time and you don't really take emergency plan steps, it probably wouldn't count as an exercise. However, if the electrical outage goes out for a whole afternoon and you start executing aspects of your plan, that would potentially count as an exercise if you, again, as you point out, do the after-action assessment and document that. So that one's a little bit of a gray area. I think that what does implementing your emergency plan mean? That's a gray area, but that's what it says. So if you don't implement your emergency plan, if it just goes out briefly, you haven't really implemented it, I don't think it would count. If you can claim with a straight face to the surveyor that you honestly implemented your emergency plan because you didn't know how long the power was going to be out, then I think that would count if you have the proper documentation. So, again, it's a little subjective there. So I think we might be running out on time. Do you want to close this out?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think we've tried to provide you with as much information and perspective as we can at this point in time. I think the one last point I would make is that these are human beings who will be conducting these surveys, who will be, looking at your clinic in the same way that they do your regular rural health clinic survey and certification. And as we know with the survey and certification process, how a surveyor views this and what the surveyor's expectations may be are critically important. So Nathan and I can tell you, well, this is our interpretation, and this is what we think is reasonable, and we can share with you what the CMS guidance may be. But that individual surveyor is the person that you're going to ultimately have to satisfy. And they may focus in on different things. They may focus in on things that we've not talked about. They may give very short shrift to some things. You have to understand that there is a human component, a human element to all of this, which is impossible to predict. What we've tried to do is give you what we think are some reasonable guidelines, some reasonable interpretations and application of these. Obviously, this is brand new. As this goes on and we see more, what surveyors, what kinds of questions, what kinds of examples of what they find will or will not be acceptable, we'll be able to do more. This presentation in a year from now may be able to be more explicit in terms of the questions. This is what we know now. This is what we wanted to get out there and hope you found it helpful.
Thank you, everyone, and good luck with November 15th.
Yeah, and I just want to close by saying that, you know, the National Association of Rural Health Clinics, in conjunction with the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy, you know, we've put this on with the idea of trying to help educate, as we said. Please encourage others who may be interested to register for the RHC Technical Assistance Series. In addition, we welcome you to email us with your thoughts and suggestions for future call topics. Send those to bf@narhc.org and be sure to put RHCTA topic in the email subject line. We anticipate scheduling the next RHCTA call in about a month, and a notice will be sent by email for those who've registered for this call series with the details on that. Again, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's call.
Thank you. That concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time. Speakers, please stand by for post-conference.